It's been 2 weeks since Halloween, so it seems like a good time to talk about fear again, but not in the haunted house and roller coaster sense of fear, the kind that makes you scream and then makes you laugh. We'll talk real fear in this hour, primarily when you see it in other people. What kind of a response does that produce in you? Do you want to help the fearful person, or do you want to get away? Or do you feel nothing? The whole range is explored in Abigail Marsh's book, The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. Abigail Marsh lives in Washington, D.C. and works as an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Georgetown University. She is the director of the Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience. Thanks for joining us today, Abigail.
Thanks for having me.
Oddly enough, the book starts with insects' ability to fly. Why that?
I love the example of insects' ability to fly because very early on, scientists doing preliminary calculations many years ago determined that it was impossible for insects to actually fly based on the known laws of physics at that time. And that just serves to give scientists a little bit of humility about how much we know about the world around us at any given moment. Because, of course, our eyes tell us and our intuition tells us that insects can fly just fine. So if something needs fixing, it's clearly the known laws. And the same principle applies to altruism, I think, which for many years people saw as incompatible with the known laws of human behavior, and yet it does exist.
So by all rights, altruism should have gone extinct in humans long ago, simply because the people who are altruistic are the ones who tend to get stomped on by mastodons and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, this was something that Darwin puzzled over, that, you know, according to the sort of the most, I don't know, surface reading of the laws of fitness, survival of the fittest, people who sacrifice their own well-being to help others should have gone extinct. They should have been outcompeted by more selfish individuals. But we know that altruism exists. We can see us around us every day. So it's the job of science to try to figure out why.
And altruism is really just the sense of wanting to do things for other people regardless, and sometimes against the good of your own personal well-being.
That's exactly right, to be genuinely motivated by a desire to help somebody else.
So you met a few altruists over the years. Tell us about the guy who helped you on the highway when you were 19.
Well, interestingly, this took place on Interstate 5, which is, I imagine, not too far from where you are.
About a mile.
Exactly. It's about a mile from where I grew up as well, in Tacoma. What happened is I was driving back home to Tacoma from a night in Seattle, fairly late one night. Luckily, it was a clear night, and the traffic wasn't too heavy. But what happened was that I was driving over the overpass toward the Tacoma Dome when a little dog ran out in front of my car. And I swerved to avoid the dog, which you shouldn't do, as I learned, because it sent the car into a fishtail and then a spin across the freeway. And it wound up in the fast lane of the freeway facing backward into the oncoming traffic, and the spinning around caused the engine to die. So I was really stuck. I couldn't get the car to turn back on. There was no shoulder to escape onto. The way that my car was positioned meant that the semis and the trucks and cars were swerving just barely in time to avoid me because they couldn't see me until they crested the bridge. Anyways, I thought I was going to die for sure. And then a stranger appeared at the passenger's window of my car and said, "You look like you could use some help." And he proceeded to get my car going again, got me back across the freeway, made sure that I was going to be all right, and then he just disappeared again. He didn't tell me his name, So I couldn't even thank him.
So when did you begin to link altruism like that to perceptions of fear, and how? How'd you make that linkage?
Well, so I was conducting some research for my doctoral dissertation when I was at Harvard as a PhD student. And I discovered that in the laboratory, people who engage in relatively minor acts of altruism for a stranger, for example, volunteering to help, volunteer to help, or donate money to somebody that they've never met before, was pretty strongly correlated with how well they could recognize fearful facial expressions in a totally different laboratory task. And it just seemed like an odd finding. Even the primary goal of the study was to figure out that relationship. But I was able to make sense of it by looking at this very large literature on a disorder called psychopathy, which is associated with a callous and uncaring personality and being very antisocial. And there was this big body of research showing that people who were psychopathic are really bad at recognizing others' fearful expressions. And so that kind of tipped me off that maybe there's some intrinsic relationship between how caring people are towards other people and their sensitivity to other people's fear.
So in the days before you had functional MRI, the real-time MRI, fMRI, mm-hmm. How did you? What kinds of confirming experiments could you do?
Well, you know, not much, right? Before we had fMRI, there was a lot of indirect experiments you would do. You would show people facial expressions in the laboratory and have them try to identify what they're looking at. And those are nice, simple, straightforward studies to replicate. And then you could try to measure behavior, but measuring altruism and aggression in the laboratory is really difficult because people know that they're being studied in the laboratory and their behavior is really strongly affected by what they believe you want them to do or what you expect them to do, which is why the research on psychopathy is so helpful, because you can look at what people do in the lab when they're looking at facial expressions, and then you can cross-check that against their behavior on the real world. And again, what we found is that people who engage in a lot of what's called proactive aggression, which is deliberate, goal-directed aggression to get something by hurting others, is, again, pretty well correlated with people's ability to recognize fear in the lab.
All right, and before we go to the break, I want to make clear, when we talk about psychopathy, we're talking about psychopaths. And so
exactly.
Are their brains different? I mean, just give us a teaser on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Psychopaths have a key difference in a brain region called the amygdala that's about 8% smaller than average.
All right, we'll unpack this a bit more as we go through the book with Abigail Marsh. She is an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Georgetown University, director of the Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience. Her book is The Fear Factor: How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. We'll come back and talk more about fear and how we perceive it and what we do with that perception when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We're getting a peek inside the human brain once again today with Dr. Abigail Marsh from Georgetown University, where she directs the Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience. She looks at how people respond to fear. Some people see fear in another person's face and feel like they have to do something. Some people feel nothing at all. The first is an altruist. The second is a psychopath. Most of us, we suspect, somewhere in between. Her book is called The Fear Factor: How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760, email jx@jeffnet.org. So Abigail, we just established that there are differences in the amygdala in people who are psychopaths, who are having psychopathy. Is it a structural difference or just a functional how they use it kind of thing?
It's actually both. So in studies with adolescents who have psychopathic traits, which I study in my own lab, we found that their amygdalas are quite a bit smaller than average, again, around 10%, and that they're also less responsive to social and emotional events. In particular, they're less responsive to images of other people who are in fear.
So when you say 10%, you mean they're smaller by 10%, or they're 10% of the size of a person who's going to normally...
Oh, sorry, they're smaller by 10%.
Okay. That would be a huge difference otherwise.
That would be... Yeah, that would be massive.
Right. Okay. So we do love a book that has oxytocin on page 7. Would you remind us what that is and how that figures in this equation?
Sure. Oxytocin is an ancient hormone that's produced in the brains of all mammals and that plays a key role in generating parental care, so in motivating parents to care for their babies.
All right. So it's the bonding hormone. Is that the usual name for it?
Yeah. That's one of its main roles.
And so is there a presence or lack that figures in development of the amygdala or how we use it when we're seeing fear in other people's face? How does it come into this equation?
It's a really good question, and it's one that's pretty hard to answer in people because an fMRI machine only allows us to look at blood flow in the brain, so it can show us that a structure like the amygdala is recruiting more blood to it and it's probably more active, but it doesn't allow us to figure out what's going on at the level of specific neurotransmitters like oxytocin. But there's... Sorry, what's that?
No, go ahead.
Oh, sure. There's some great animal research out there, though, that can give us a pretty good clue. And research with rodents, like rats and voles, have shown that there is a huge amount of receptors for oxytocin within the amygdala, and the activity within those oxytocin receptors in the amygdala seems to be a huge driver of parental care in, for example, mother rat.
So the possibility exists that there's some flush of oxytocin when we see fear in somebody's face and we feel like we have to do something for them?
This is what I am hypothesizing. One of the really interesting things about fearful expressions is how much they resemble baby faces. So if you wanted to make an adult human face look more babyish, you really couldn't do better than a fearful expression. They've got these big eyes and raised eyebrows, and they look sort of rounded and vulnerable. And so what may happen is that when we are confronted with somebody else who looks afraid, that sort of overall infantile appearance revs up the oxytocin system. And then through its activity in the amygdala, it motivates us to, instead of acting to help ourselves, which is what we often do in response to fear cues, the oxytocin motivates us to go out and help the person who's afraid instead.
So the potential message to our brains is child needs help.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, wow. That could be some interesting. It would certainly explain a lot, wouldn't it?
It would. It would help us get around this interesting problem of why it is that when people confront somebody else who's afraid, they seem to be motivated to help rather than to run away themselves.
So when we come back to your encounter with an altruist, your dog freeway spin out encounter, first of all, was it an Isuzu Trooper?
It was an SUV, but no, it was not a Trooper. Why do you ask?
Oh, just curious. There have been some stories about them over the years. But
well, this was another make of SUV that did not have a very good reputation and hard turns, I will say that.
But as I think about the approach of the person who knew that somebody was in need, it was dark at night, and they probably couldn't see your face or any expression then, could they?
This is a great question. I wish I knew the answer to. It would be, I think, way too dangerous to try to recreate the whole event. But, you know, I had turned my brights on after the accident to try to maximize the odds that cars could see me when they were approaching. And I don't know whether somebody who was approaching in a different lane would have been able to see my face through the windshield or not. It's a good question.
So did the incident actually make your desire to learn psychology burn that much brighter in you?
Absolutely. I think I was always interested in psychology, but I didn't really appreciate the extent to which behaviors like altruism can be studied in a systematic, scientific way until I started studying psychology, and I realized that this particular question of interest to me was something I might be able to tackle.
And so social psychology, is that where you ended up?
That's where I started, yeah. I got my PhD in social psychology.
Which means what versus regular other, you know, plain vanilla psychology?
Sort of depends on who you ask, but social psychology historically was involved in looking at the psychology of social behavior and how people interact with each other.
We're talking to Abigail Marsh at Georgetown University about her book, The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. So we get to moral agents and moral patients. What's the difference between them?
Oh, so the moral philosophy thinks about any kind of moral action as having the agent, who's the doer, the person who engages in a moral or immoral action. And then the moral patient is the one who has the immoral or moral thing done to them.
All right. So it's people who do and people who have done to.
Exactly.
In essence. So does anybody count the percentages? Do we have any idea in society who might, you know, what percentage of people are moral agents and what percentage moral patients?
Well, we certainly have, most of us, been in both situations at some time or another. But, you know, I've actually tried hard to look for data on, you know, what percent of people have ever engaged in a sort of major life-saving act in the U.S., and it's really hard to figure out those statistics. It's much easier to come up with statistics for immoral acts, you know, what percent of people have ever committed an aggressive crime. But that's really only half the equation.
So there's a chance that you can convert. You can become generally a moral patient, but in a moment of need or seeing fear in somebody's face, you could become a moral agent?
Sure, absolutely.
So the example of Cory Booker when he was mayor of Newark running into a fire, and this is a really interesting part of this because, you know, the general assumption about people who do such things is, wow, they're just totally fearless. But as he describes, he was full of fear, and he did it anyway.
I love this example. Exactly. It's a really incredible story of what Cory Booker did when he was still the mayor of Newark. He came home and found that his neighbor's house was on fire, and the fire was pretty extensive by that point. And one of his neighbors was outside screaming that her daughter was still in the building. And Booker was with his detectives, and they really did not want him running into that building. And he had to fight them off in order to run up into the building, fight his way through the flames and the choking black smoke that was in there, hunt down his neighbor, who was nearly unconscious on a bed in the upstairs part of the building, and then pick her up on his shoulders and carry her back out through the kitchen with flames and ashes raining down on them, and back out the door. And of course, people just were incredulous that he had done something so incredibly brave, and people painted him as this sort of Chuck Norris type stoic hero in the whole event. And he couldn't have protested strongly enough how terrified he was throughout the entire incident.
Yeah, I remember that. You mentioned it now. I forgot about the jokes about this, about, you know, that when Chuck Norris has nightmares, Cory Booker reads him a book to get him back to sleep.
Right, exactly. Right. Or Cory Booker isn't afraid of the dark. The dark is afraid of Cory Booker.
So you must have interviewed, in addition to all the studies and scans and data, a few altruists along the way. Have you found some common personality traits or just things that they share?
Yeah, absolutely. So the altruists that I've been studying in my own research at Georgetown are people who've donated a kidney to a stranger. Most of them are what are called non-directed kidney donors, which means that they decided to donate a kidney to literally whoever on the list needed it next. And they knew that they might never meet this person and would certainly not meet them before the surgery, which qualifies clearly as a pretty extraordinary form of altruism. And in working with them, it's really been a wonderful experience to get to meet them and hear more about their experiences. And some of the things I've learned about them is that, like Cory Booker, they never describe themselves as fearless. Even though many people who have not donated a kidney to a stranger say that one of the major reasons they wouldn't donate is because they're afraid of what might happen during the surgery. The kidney donors, they experience fear in other areas of their lives. You know, we've had a couple who were asked us if they were able to take anti-anxiety medications on the plane flight to Georgetown because they're afraid of flying, and others are so afraid of needles that they sometimes pass out when they get a blood draw. But it seems like when they are in the process of donating their kidney, their focus on helping the other person completely overrides their fear for their own well-being. It's really pretty amazing.
So they can be fearful of other things, including needle sticks, and surgery is obviously a lot more than a needle stick, and yet, you know, the idea of like, yeah, so I'm asleep, they take the kidney out, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really interesting example of the possibility that one of the best ways to regulate fear for yourself is to not focus on yourself, is to focus on some other goal, like helping another person.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in this book yet. The book is called The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. It's the work of Abigail Marsh, an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at Georgetown University. She directs the Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience. Your thoughts, when have you seen fear on somebody's face, and what did it make you do? Have you surprised yourself with your responses to fear in human beings over the years, one way or the other? We'd like to hear from you. Remember, it is first names only. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We have an email in here from Scott in Ashland. He says, I wonder if there's been any study of another category of predatory individuals, different from psychopaths, who seem adept at recognizing fear and responding by exploiting it. People I'll call, for lack of a better word, bullies. Is there any scientific basis for identifying and categorizing such people? That from Scott in Ashland.
Well, it's an interesting question. There's more than one category of bully. Some bullies really are psychopathic. And it's interesting that they do seem to recognize when other people are easy targets. And for example, are vulnerable or small or not likely to fight back for whatever reason. But even then, they still don't seem to recognize fear per se. They might be able to recognize that the person's in a vulnerable situation when they look afraid. For example, one of my colleagues told me an amazing story once about a psychopath that she was interviewing in a prison. And she was doing an emotion recognition task with him. And he missed every single fearful facial expression in the set, which is really a very poor performance, even for somebody who's a psychopath. And he sort of knew he was doing badly because when he got to the very last fearful expression, he said, you know, I don't know what that expression is called, but I know that's what people look like right before I stab them. So he knew he'd seen this expression before. He just couldn't come up with what the emotional label was for it. That said, there are other bullies as well who are more likely to bully as a result of having been bullied themselves, and that's sort of a different category. And for those kinds of bullies where it's more of a response to what has been done to them in the past, you would probably see a different kind of effect where they would be legitimately sensitive to other people's fear, but due to probably emotion dysregulation issues in themselves, as well as some social learning processes, they still don't respond compassionately to it.
And there was another portion of the book that was almost as astounding as what you just talked about, where somebody was asked to draw the faces of different emotions, and she just came up with blank faces for fear?
That's right. So this is a fascinating individual whose name we know only as SM. She's protected by only having her initials revealed. And what's unusual about her is that a genetic disorder resulted in her amygdalas calcifying sometime during her teenage years, so that they're totally gone, and most of the rest of her brain is totally intact. And what it has meant is that she is now, as an adult, essentially totally unable to recognize other people's fear because her amygdala is completely gone. And in addition, when the researchers who studied her asked her to draw what different expressions might look like, she did really well drawing anger and sadness and disgust and other emotions. They were really sort of evocative portraits that she drew. But she literally couldn't come up with anything when she was asked to draw fear. She quite literally drew a blank. She protested. She couldn't think of anything. She didn't know what it would be called. She tried a couple things and threw them away. And then finally ended up drawing not a face at all, which was completely different than for the other emotions, but just this little sort of round crawling figure on its hands and knees with its hair sticking up and this sort of odd, definitely not fearful face, but sort of an odd look on its face.
Wow. So just had no idea how to portray the facial part of it. Does this go in any tandem with the way that some people do forget faces later in life? Was it prosopagnosia?
Prosopagnosia, exactly. So prosopagnosia is another interesting disorder that is an inability to recognize familiar faces. So you even faces of people you know very well, like your parents or your best friend or even sometimes yourself in a mirror, you don't recognize them when you see them. And there's no intrinsic relationship between sensitivity to other people's fear and sensitivity to facial identity. So you can be good at one or bad at the other or vice versa. But the main interesting relationship is that we used to think that prosopagnosia was very, very rare and only resulted from sort of strokes or accidents later in life. But as time's gone on, we've realized that actually the ability to recognize faces is something that varies continuously in the population, with many people born with difficulties recognizing faces, and then most people somewhere in the middle, and then a sort of high end of people who were super face recognizers. And that's really interesting because it looks like many other human traits and abilities follow that same sort of continuous curve, including, as my own research has shown, compassion.
So compassion versus empathy, is there a difference between them, and is it generally spurred by fear or sadness or just negative emotions that we perceive in others?
So empathy is a really broad term, and it means a lot of different things, and so it's important just to be specific in the kind of empathy that we're talking about. Empathy generally means some sort of an emotional response to other people's emotions, so you could even have an empathic happy response to somebody else's happiness. But the kind of empathy that seems to matter the most for caring and altruistic behavior is an empathic reaction to other people's distress, which could mean sadness, could even mean pain. But fear seems to be the one that matters the most, at least if you look at the ability to predict actual behavior. And so if you have an empathic response to somebody else's fear, it may mean that you're actually creating in your brain a sort of a weak little simulation of what that emotion is that the other person's feeling, which then allows you to identify what they're feeling, and then leads to this other form of empathy, which is sometimes called sympathy or compassion or care, which triggers you not only to recognize what they're feeling, but to want to do something about it and to make it better.
So I'm not surprised to see things like the famous Milgram study in your book, where people thought they were delivering lethal shocks to other human beings. That alone is scary. What did psychologists think would happen?
Fascinatingly, Milgram, before he started his research, polled a lot of mental health professionals on how many people they thought would continue shocking, giving the electric shock to a stranger, even after he complained that his heart was bothering him and pounded on the wall and went silent. And very few psychiatrists and psychologists thought that people would be willing to do that simply in response to an authority figure's telling them to do so. And so everybody was astonished at how many people are willing to comply with that kind of instruction.
So in current psychological thinking, when people do things that they wouldn't normally do. Do we chalk that up to things that come from within the individual or something about group dynamics, like the Stanford Prison Study, things like that?
Well, it's always sort of a complicated combination of both. The Milgram Study is a great example of that. For example, in the Milgram Study that is in the video that I show my introductory psychology students every year, when the experimenter is standing right next to the subject and telling them, you know, you have to continue giving these shocks, the experiment must continue, about half of the people are willing to continue shocking the subject until the end. But that means half the people are not. So clearly there is some really important individual difference making an impact there.
We will talk more about this whole continuum from altruism to psychopathy. Abigail Marsh's book is called The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. I see a couple of calls on the line. We'll get to those in just a couple of moments when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Dr. Abigail Marsh, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at Georgetown University. She directs the Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience and has been looking into people's brains to look for reactions to fear. And she's written a book about all the things she's learned over the years. The Fear Factor is the title of the book, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we've talked a fair amount about the altruists so far and haven't quite gotten to the psychopaths just yet, but when you do get into psychopaths in the book, you pick a good one, the Green River Killer. What did he say about why he killed people?
So the person who knows the most, one of the people who knows the most about the Green River Killer is a former FBI profiler named Mary Ellen O'Toole, who I got to meet briefly when we were at an event about the science of psychopathy. And she did call him one of the most psychopathic individuals she has ever encountered, just sort of a pure predator. And you always have to take psychopaths' explanations for their behavior with a grain of salt because they're very good at manipulating people and they tend to lie a lot. But he wanted to kill people just for the feeling of power over them, as far as we can tell.
Wow. So, and this is proactive aggression. A term you used earlier in the hour. That the idea being that this is not based on somebody getting mad at somebody for another thing or in any way returning something.
That's right. Most aggression in the world is what's called reactive aggression, which is usually born out of intense rage or frustration. Maybe somebody took something from you or threatened you, and it made you feel intensely upset. And you sort of lash out before you quite realize what you're doing. And that's obviously not a good thing to do. But most people who behave that way feel remorseful afterwards, and they try not to do it again. And that goes the same for children, by the way. The most violent year of a person's life is age 2, statistically speaking. And so many parents of young kids I know are very worried about all the aggression they see in their young kids. But again, it's almost always reactive, sort of temper tantrum-y aggression. Proactive aggression is a lot scarier. It's a kind of aggression that is not born of any kind of rage or intense emotion. It's just driven by wanting something and being perfectly willing to use aggression to get it. So if you want, to wield power over somebody, if you have some sort of sexual fetishes like the Green River Killer also clearly had, if you have a proactive aggression risk, you have no qualms about using aggression and hurting other people to get what it is you want.
Is it present? Is it something that, a small percentage of the population is likely to use?
Exactly. There are many different kinds of psychological disorders linked to reactive aggression, which can be caused by increased anxiety or depression or even psychosis. So, for example, people who are schizophrenic. The only disorder that's linked with increased proactive aggression is psychopathy, which, again, it varies continuously in the population, so there's not really a sharp cutoff. But most estimates say that only about 2% of the population is extremely psychopathic. So it is a pretty small percentage of people.
All right. Since we've just used the words in the same paragraph, I want to distinguish. There is a difference between psychosis and psychopathy. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a really important distinction. So psychopathy, again, is this personality disorder that you see in people who are totally sane by the sort of traditional definition. They don't have hallucinations or delusions. They know what they're doing in the moment. They could tell you, you know, whether their behavior is legal or illegal. They just don't care about other people's suffering. They are willing to hurt other people to get what they want. And that's different from psychosis, which is being insane, again, in the classical sense of the word. It means having hallucinations or delusions.
So what is the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
This is a great question. The terms have sort of waxed and waned in terms of which one's popular through the years. The older term is psychopath, and it was it's an old term that, you know, usually meant somebody who had this what was called once the mask of sanity. They seem from the outside like a perfectly capable, ordinary person, but again, underneath they have this incredibly callous and uncaring demeanor. And there's, again, pretty good evidence that there's a strongly heritable component to psychopathy, meaning that genetics account for at least some proportion of it. The term fell out of favor in the 70s and 80s as the sort of views about where aggression and antisocial behavior come from. And there was a period of time where people believed in the idea of the blank slate, where we're all born completely unformed, and everything that we do in our lives is a product of learning and our social environments. And so the term sociopath took hold as indicating that antisocial behavior in people like this is due to social forces, like the way that they were parented or other experiences in their life. And it's, you know, become clear over time that that's probably not really true. And so psychopath has become the more popular term again. But I should hasten to add, there are plenty of other reasons people could become antisocial other than psychopathy. And there's sort of this bigger term now called antisocial personality disorder that's the catch-all for other forms of antisociality.
One big bin for the whole range of things.
Okay. Yeah, unfortunately.
Right. Let's take a call. We have Sheila and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Abigail Marsh, the author of The Fear Factor.
Thank you. I'd like to ask Dr. Marsh sort of the other end of it, of fear. Like I read that like children who are abused and have a very hard childhood and they grow up thinking that they're more or less indestructible, and so they have a lack of fear of certain situations and people. They don't really have fear. They think they're...
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks for that. Let's pick it up from there, Sheila. Thanks.
Yeah, so the relationship between life experiences and how fearful or fearless people turn out is complex, obviously. But the best evidence suggests that children are born sort of towards one end of the fear spectrum or the other. Some kids are what is called very inhibited when they're born, where they're quite nervous and easily frightened by things, and some are relatively uninhibited. And it's true that life experiences can influence those things as time goes on, but it doesn't seem to be the case that being exposed to severe abuse or trauma causes people to become fearless. If anything, it's usually the other way around, that children who are abused or traumatized are more likely to become highly anxious and sort of emotionally dysregulated over time.
In fact, with the Green River Killer, weren't there some claims that his upbringing did some things to him, but then when you look at the rest of society at the same time, it really wasn't that far out of what was the norm?
Yeah, there was some... I mean, people want a reason that people end up acting in such incredibly deviant ways. They want there to be some obvious thing we can point to, and if we could just get rid of that thing, we wouldn't end up with any more serial killers. And so, some of his biographers tried to come up with reasons, you know, things his parents had done that might have made him act the way he did. But the worst of it was that his parents sometimes fought, you know, sort of throwing plates and things. It wasn't anything that rises to the level of true abuse. And certainly nothing nearly so far out of the ordinary as to explain his behaviors, which are incredibly far out of the ordinary. So it doesn't seem like it's a simple story like that at all.
Now, so you have been examining young people at the laboratory at Georgetown, I know, and had some real horror stories from their parents, for sure, about the things they've had to put up with in the kids. Now, you do point out there's a real resistance, though, to calling children psychopaths. Why?
Yeah, exactly. So the term psychopath is really stigmatizing, obviously. And we really try hard to not call children psychopaths, and I don't. Because, you know, we can assess them for similar traits as we would find in adults, but we don't really know what's going to happen to them as they develop. And it's sometimes the case that children who seem to be psychopathic when they're younger seem to basically grow out of it. They lose those traits entirely as they develop for reasons we don't really know. Or sometimes it just turns out that we had misassessed them to begin with, that what looked like psychopathy was actually an unusual form of early bipolar disorder or something like that, and it really never was psychopathy to begin with. But I should say that this is kind of in line with the way that we talk about all mental illnesses now. You know, once upon a time, we talked about schizophrenics as a personnel or as a group of people with mental illness, and you would never hear that phrasing anymore. It's always people with schizophrenia. And so I think the same is really true for psychopathy.
Let's take another call. We have Jim in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Abigail Marsh.
Yes, good morning. Very quickly, something like this we talked about the other day with my friends. Take a subject that normal young people are very body English, they're wanting to know more, expressing themselves. Put that same person in with certain family members, and when certain religious subjects comes up, both the verbal and the just the come on, keep talking body English just dries up. It's very interesting. Put the same people in a different group, different house, then talk about religion and keep going, but with that family member in the room, everything dies up.
Interesting. So it's who the people around you are at the time of having a discussion. Thanks for that, Jim. Any thoughts on that, Abigail?
Oh, sure. I mean, it certainly is true that people's behavior changes a lot depending on the context they're in, and we all know that certain family settings and family relationships are definitely driving lots of emotional behavior.
We have a question here from Doug, No Town Given, wants to know if you see a greater level or a correlation between adverse childhood experiences and psychopathy.
So, yes. So we do see that in people who have extremely antisocial outcomes as adults, that they are more likely to have experienced adversity in childhood. What's difficult to tease apart is why that is. And so the best studies that have looked at why this relationship pops up are adoption studies, where children are raised by adoptive mothers, and then you can look at the difference between the effects of genetics, which are contributed by biological parents, and the effects of the rearing environment. And what some of these studies have found is consistent with what we have learned in the past, which is that there is a biological component to psychopathy. So children who have biological mothers who are very fearless are more likely to and also antisocial, are more likely to have fearless traits and callous personalities in childhood. That said, what's really cool about this particular study that came out recently is that it also showed that the way that parents treated children can mitigate that risk. So it's the biological parent is contributing some genetic risk factors, but if adoptive mothers were extremely warm and responsive, so not just average warm and responsive, but really on the high end, they could mitigate the risk factors in children. So they could reduce the callousness that those children were showing back down to normal levels, which gives us some real reason for optimism.
And is there a correlation between psychopathy and IQ as well?
This has been a topic of debate for a while. Not a strong one. The main difference is that most people who are in detention or who are in prisons tend to have IQs that are a little bit lower than average. And this is, you know, a well-established outcome that has been found. And what's interesting about people who are psychopathic is that their IQs tend to be average. So they're relatively high IQs for, if you're studying prison populations, for a prison population. There's also some evidence that people who have psychopathic personalities and higher IQs tend to commit worse crimes, possibly because they are better at figuring out what they can get away with it and escalating the kind of behavior they're engaged in over time.
So let's go to the other end of the spectrum now. Leave some time for the altruists here. Any correlation with IQ and altruism?
Not that I've been able to detect. Again, it seems like the people that we have been recruiting who are altruistic kidney donors have the same IQs as ordinary adults.
And this is a pretty wild thing, though, because there's some great examples of altruists in the world. Lenny Skutnik, who dove into freezing water to rescue plane crash survivors in Washington, D.C. in the 80s. You could not bring him into your studies. Why?
Well, so university research is regulated by these internal review boards that are designed to protect the outcomes and the welfare of human subjects, which is obviously very important. And one of the things that we're not allowed to do is to present any appearance of coercing people to participate in our research. And going out in the world and cold calling people that you know to be very altruistic and asking them if they could participate in a study might and look like the kind of thing that makes it too hard for them to say no. And so you're not really allowed to do that. So would I be thrilled if he contacted us and wanted to participate? Yes, but I cannot go out after him and contact him myself.
Darn. Love to hear more about his story, and I'd love to see an fMRI on him as well. But so let's come back to the psychopath, though, before we go, and let us know if there's any hope. I mean, does it appear that a developing brain that shows to be a psychopathic personality so far can be treated? Is there hope?
I think these studies of children of adopted families are very promising, and then they suggest that if we can identify children who are at risk early, sort of like we do with children who are autistic, and we can engage in really targeted behavioral training, I think we really could make a difference.
There's some real fascinating stuff in here. The book is called The Fear Factor, How One Emotion Connects Altruists, Psychopaths, and Everyone in Between. It's the work of Abigail Marsh at the Laboratory on Social and Affective Neuroscience at Georgetown University. Abigail, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care.